Welcome to the Legacy and Faith Show, featuring estate and tax attorney Paul Grant. The Legacy and Faith Show is about the journey of discovering how to create plans that protect wealth and family values for generations. And now the host of the Legacy and Faith Show, Paul Grant.
Along with co-host Mark Holland, it's the Legacy and Faith Show with Paul Grant once again. Hi there, Paul.
Hi, Mark.
Hey, we're in a series about the foundational questions that you ask people when they come in and want to start a trust, and we're continuing that discussion this week.
Yeah, we've looked at some of the initial questions, so past podcasts, you can find it at legacyandfaith.com. We've talked through how do you name a trust? Who do we put in charge? What about beneficiaries? What do we do if we don't want to include a beneficiary? And several other items. So really, this would be things that someone could expect by coming into the office. I find that I try to do more detailed work, ask more deep questions. So therefore, I wanted to give the listeners an opportunity to hear what would it sound like if you go to an estate planner. Of course, you know my philosophy, which is every person needs to do estate planning. So I don't care how much you have or don't have. This isn't about taxes all the ways. It's about making sure that you're well taken care of, making sure you have the proper documentation around yourself if you ever become disabled, if you ever experience a health incident. And then when you pass away, we want to make sure that this last act of stewardship is passed off well, that it gets to the right people in the right way, and that we have considerations of what does it mean to support kingdom work or charities? What does it mean to make sure that our family is well taken care of? What are the issues that we may need to discuss around family? So there's always much more involved in versus simply just getting money to someone. And I thought it would be useful if we take a little bit of a deeper dive into what does it mean to sit down and actually talk through some of the questions, and not just the questions themselves, but actually, why am I asking that? So what's going on in the estate planner's head, and why is this a critical or important question? So that's our series, and kind of looking at all my different notes and stuff, we may be on this topic for just a little bit. So there's a lot of things that we go through, and I want to give a really good description and a really good taste to what would it look like if you come into the Office of Planning with Purpose and we do some estate planning together, because everybody needs it.
Well, do go to the website for the previous shows and a lot of the questions that are foundational. He's discussed there, but we're moving along here. With the idea that you always try and bring out the person who needs to be taken care of in the trust first is the person, is the main person who stands to be affected by choices.
Yeah, the client themselves, right?
The whole idea of putting on the oxygen mask first when
right.
in a plane
yeah, that's
emergency.
Right.
If you can't, if you're not taken care of, you can't take care of others. So.
Yeah, and unfortunately, the thought process when they come into the office is, well, we're going to talk about dying. And yes, we're going to get to that topic, and because who doesn't like talking about that topic? Because the more fun topic is, what happens if I'm ever incapacitated, right? Mm. So both of these topics are phenomenal. But yes, the first issue is always, how do I care for the person in front of me? And I review documents all the time, Mark. And what I see is that a majority that come across my desk are very templated. And so they lack specificity and for the client themselves. So it's one thing to say, hey, I give you all access to my bank account if I can't manage my own financial affairs. And yet it is a completely different discussion and document that says, not only do I give you access, because whoever's going to assist you, step up to the plate, pay your bills, manage your investments. Okay, they need access, but they also need direction. So what would it look like, not only from the creator's perspective, if you know that you have really good, solid instructions given to somebody, and how much more comfortable does it make the person who's going to step into that position when they have really good instructions? Mm. And I often make this correlation, which is most men out there, specifically if you're married, you are probably familiar with a store called IKEA. And I don't know, it kind of make not exactly sure it's my favorite place. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the thing about IKEA is that you walk through a huge warehouse and you see these nice put together products. And then you go to the back of the warehouse where you pull it off of a shelf in a box. Mm-hmm. So then you get the joy of going home and opening up the package only to find that there are literal instructions with stick figures in them. Mm-hmm. And that's how I feel most estate planning is that you open up the box, so you have to use the document at some point. And lo and behold, you're the person who needs to take up this document and start functioning with it. Mm. And you come to find that the instructions are so general that if you change the person's name at the beginning of the page and you change the signature page, that everything in between is probably exactly the same thing that the person before got. So in estate planning, is that really what you want your document to look like? And is that really the document that you want to hand to someone that you have deemed to be responsible and you're going to ask them to step in the gap and fill in the gap, specifically if you're disabled, and say, come alongside of me and assist me? So what if you're unable to give really good instructions at that moment in time because you are trying to recover or you're fighting for your life? Then the document most of the time is simply a, here are the coffers that are opened up. Again, that's an important step. Yes, we need access. But I don't like stick figure estate planning. So we need something far more detailed. We need to give instructions that will make the individual understand and have some direction from the creator of the document on, so for example, what is your investment philosophy? Do you want somebody investing in cryptocurrencies with your money?
Okay.
So most individuals that I meet...
That can be part of a trust?
Sure, it can be. And it can also...
Don't put your money in crypto.
That's right.
My money.
So how about trading on margins? How about investing in penny stocks? So these type of investment philosophies or opportunities, most individuals would say those are high risk investments. And if they want to give authority to someone else to invest in those type of opportunities, it would typically be very minimal. But what I have found is that when I ask that question, most people say no, because if we're needing to utilize our finances more, because typically when we have a health incident, there are higher bills, there's a higher likelihood that we need to preserve our assets, then what does it look like if we need to shift our investments to meet that current challenge? And do you want someone gambling with your money? So some people would say that's about similar, like going down to Vegas and throwing it on the roulette table and say, let's go black. Now, there are other people who are very comfortable with more high-risk investments. And you may say, even if you're comfortable with them, if I am having a health challenge, I would rather not – I don't want someone else to be investing in that style. So now I have just one simple question out of a multitude of different questions that we've presented to the creator of the document, and it flushes out and gives better instructions to the one who's going to assist. So that's good. But number two is that it gives greater confidence to the one who's creating the documents, the client, to say, my assets are going to be well managed in the hands of this person. Now, typically we choose someone who we trust already. We believe that they're responsible. That's a whole different topic of why would I prefer a trust instrument over a financial power of attorney? There are better boundaries in a trust than there are a financial power attorney, in my opinion. But just one question may already start to spark other questions. So also, who are the beneficiaries? We touched on this briefly in a different show. But we have to select the right people. We have to give them the right instructions. So caring for the person first, getting the right documents first, a financial power of attorney, healthcare power of attorney, mental health power of attorney, end-of-life documents. These documents ensure that the client themselves is first the priority. Then we can make sure that when someone passes away, we have everything set up with the estate plan to pass appropriately as that person and client
sees. Is this as much of a consideration after the person obviously has passed away? Maybe it's person is the trustee is more empowered to do what they see best because you've already passed away.
So sometimes, if we use a will, that may be so. There, in a will, it's a general instruction instrument. Okay, so it gives us who the beneficiaries are. It tells us who is going to be that personal representative. It gives court instructions. So a majority of a will package is going to be statutorily driven. In other words, we're going to go look at Washington law, and the law has told us what a personal representative, what their duties are. Now, that's a little bit different than when you utilize a revocable living trust. In a revocable living trust, we have greater depth of instructions. Yes, there's also statutory law. There's also law behind all of this, but trusts tend to be documents that give greater depth to instructions, and there are also additional duties placed upon a successor trustee, mm-hmm. such as one I just mentioned, the duty to invest. And this carries forward even after the trust maker has died, because now we need to look at the beneficiaries and do everything in the best interest of the beneficiaries. Now, very similar in a will package, the law says you have to do everything in the best interest of the beneficiaries and, believe it or not, the creditors. Mm. So there's always creditors that have a rightful claim to an estate. It doesn't matter whether it's a will or a trust. So a trust is not going to magically shield the beneficiaries from paying the decedent's debts. That is not what a trust does. So beneficiaries and creditors have rights. But in a trust format, there tend to be greater instructions, or rather, there should be greater instructions. How's that? Because again, most documents I review come from a templated mentality, from a template, and the instructions are just simply not as rich. They're not as full. So therefore, the trustee is going to lean more upon statute, what the law says for them to do, instead of looking toward the governing document, the trust itself, for individual instructions. And I think that's really the big deal. Wills and templated trusts give general instructions. What we're trying to do with good estate planning is create very specific and individual instructions so that, yes, the general instructions are there. That's the foundation. But now, what does it mean to give specific instructions so that the person who's taking over can have the greatest amount of success, the greatest security in taking over that responsibility, and then ultimately that benefits not just them, but the beneficiaries, the estate as a whole. We get to a cleaner estate process when someone passes away. It's faster. And in my opinion, it just makes all the difference to have specific instructions instead of relying upon general instructions.
Some of the foundational questions you will be asked if you try and create a trust with Paul Grant. People are intrigued by your approach. They want to find out more. How do they get in touch with you, Paul?
Head over to my website, legacyandfaith.com. There's past podcasts, upcoming educational opportunities, and ways to communicate with us, all found at legacyandfaith.com.
Back with more of the Legacy and Faith Show with Paul Grant in just a moment.
Can I avoid probate? Will I lose everything if my health becomes compromised? How do I preserve what I have for me and my family? Will the government take it all? This is Paul Grant with the Legacy and Faith Show. These are some of the most common questions we get on a daily basis, and there are solutions for all of these issues. It is time for you to protect your family and what God has placed under your stewardship, and we can help. Go to legacyandfaith.com to find out more about our services and upcoming educational opportunities. That's legacyandfaith.com.
Your photos, slides, scrapbooks, and home movies are invaluable and irreplaceable. Barry Kenny here with the Bear Services. Call us to save them as digital files to be stored electronically and shared liberally. We will even come to you so they stay in your possession. Go to thebearservices.com for more information. That's thebearservices.com.
We now return to the Legacy and Faith Show, featuring estate and tax attorney Paul Grant, and continue today's practical discussion to apply biblical principles for kingdom purposes.
Along with co-host Mark Holland this week, looking at foundational questions that Paul would be asking you if he was going to set up a trust for you. And moving on to the subject of helping people pick the right kind of successor trustee or executor,
yeah.
We've heard that term. Pretty important role, and you prompt people with some important questions there.
Yeah, that could really be a difficult, sometimes agonizing a question for some people, specifically if they don't have a very deep personal bench. If clients never had children, then who do they lean upon? So oftentimes they look towards siblings, but the siblings are their age, oftentimes having similar health issues or concerns. What happens if you don't have strong family connections? If you do have children, are they responsible? Are they really ready for the tasks? So if they're younger, if they're in their 20s, is this really the right responsibility at such a young age? Typically, I have two daughters. They're 26 and 27, and I'm not so sure that I would want to put this type of a responsibility upon my girls at this point in time. That they're both fine with finances. Neither of them are spendthrifts. Well, maybe one is a tick of a one, I'm just saying that Amazon is rich for a reason. So, but at what age is someone really ready to meet this challenge? So, and not only that, but if you get someone in their 30s, typically they're going to be married. They may have families of their own. They have jobs. They could be extremely busy during that time of their life. So what would it look like if you had a health incident and now you're asking a child in their 30s to step in and actually assist in paying bills and doing things for you, taking you to doctor's appointments? So it becomes very difficult with some of these questions. And, each client is very different, which we need to talk through. What does it look like? Who do we have in your corner? Who are the others? Now, if we have children in our 30s, maybe you're in your 60s, maybe in your young 70s, that may be a time when you can still rely upon siblings and other people. But now we get kids into the 40s. If we don't have somebody that we really trust that doesn't have clear administrative skills, then what? Then we're starting to get our siblings into our own age range. And so let's talk through some of the characteristics that you may want to consider for someone who needs to close an estate and or help you during your lifetime. Number one, they can't be a felon. Washington law states that a trustee cannot be a felon. So, what? And that is nothing, any type of felony needs
what
to be looked at.
What if you don't know that?
Yeah, that's difficult. Well,
the person doesn't admit it.
Well, then we've got a problem, right? So then I can't control that every person is going to be truthful, but and it has yet to fall to me because I do ask the question every time, which is, has the person that you've just named to the best of your knowledge, have they ever been convicted of a felony? Now, it's not accused. It's not that you know that they committed a felony or were never caught. It's were they convicted of a felony?
Right.
And so most people know if their kids have or have not. I'm not saying that that's always true, but so we need to ask the question. I'm not so sure that other people are asking that one. And so we could end up at the time when someone passes away, when someone is in an emergency situation, if I'm asking the successor trustee at that time and they go, well, actually, yes. And now we have to move to the next successor trustee, or worse yet, there wasn't one named.
Is that kind of thing built into the trust too? What happens if your successor yes. trustee dies before you,
then, right?
And you didn't know that, and
yeah. So if something like that happened, we have relationship with our clients, and so hopefully our clients will tell us, and we will make that fine tune adjustment, name somebody else. But what if we have someone in the middle of their tenure of acting as a successor trustee have a health incident, have a life challenge, or pass away themselves, then typically we are always asking for multiple successors. So it's not just the first person that we need to concentrate on. Sometimes that's the agonizing part, but who's their follow-up? Who is the successor after the successor? And then most trusts are always going to have a clause in there that says, but if we run out of the people that we've named, then here's the process. Mm. Not every trust that I've reviewed has that process. Mm. So literally we'd be going to court if there's not sufficient language. So again, I come back to the idea of if you use a general templated document or if the instructions are not full enough, then there is a likelihood. Is it a high likelihood? Probably not, but why roll the dice and why take the chance? Let's get it done well. Let's make sure that we think through the worst case scenario. That's my job. I think through the worst case scenario, because if my documents can survive the worst case scenario, then it's going to survive very easily the best scenario. So therefore, what happens if we fully run out of successor trustees? And at the time when a successor is coming to the table, that's not the time to start getting to know them, nor is it the time to ask, do you have a felony? Because then we have to restart the whole process all the time. We have a client who may be struggling, bills aren't being paid, or just passed away, and now we cause a little more chaos. Well, I didn't, but the circumstance caused more chaos. Why? Because we didn't get to the right questions at the beginning. Asking the right question today, boy, that matters a ton. Mm. So not only do we talk about in finding the right successor trustee of whether or not they have that one mark against them, but what is their experience in investing? Do they have professional relationships already? Do they know, client, your financial advisor? So if you have a financial advisor, that person oftentimes knows why you have been investing your money and has watched and made recommendations over a period of time. Many clients don't want that disrupted, and for good reason. So because that person may have a lot of history on the thinking of how the client invested. Oftentimes what happens, I don't know percentages. I'm not even going to try to take a guess. I've really never looked it up. But it is a risk that when a child comes in and takes over as a successor trustee, if they do not know the parent's financial advisor, the child may not feel comfortable with that person. And so therefore, they may say, I feel better with my person because I have a relationship there. And if they move the assets to someone new, then we've lost the history and the voice of the one of the trust maker. So most trust makers I know want the successor to stay connected with their financial advisor. Is the trust ever talking about it? So do we introduce the important professional relationships of the client to the successor trustees? Now, all of this is not possible without a relationship with the family. And again, if someone has a templated document, there was probably not enough time to actually get introductions with the other professionals in your life, CPAs, financial advisors. the people who manage your insurance. So these are important individuals that most people have researched, feel comfortable with, and those professionals may have a lot of history on the client that is critical if we have a life change. So all of these things are very, very important. We try to do an in-depth, deeper dive into these questions to ensure that we're making sure the client is well taken care of and that the successor trustee is set up for the greatest amount of success because they have more information instead of general information.
Who's going to be that successor trustee in your trust? One of those foundational questions that Paul will ask you about when you create a trust with him and people want to know more about your services. How do they do that, Paul?
Well, head over to our website, legacyandfaith.com. There's past podcasts, upcoming educational opportunities, ways to communicate with us so we can connect, all found at legacyandfaith.com.
It's the Legacy and Faith Show with Paul Grant.
Thank you for joining us for the Legacy and Faith Show. You can find more information about the show and Paul Grant at legacyandfaith.com. Join us next week at the same time as we learn to build God's kingdom and continue our journey on how to protect wealth and family values for generations. All discussions on the Legacy and Faith Show are intended to be about general legal issues. If a situation applies to you, then we encourage you to seek specific legal advice. Please do not rely upon any discussions from this program in place of having a personal relationship with your attorney. Any listener question that may have been answered also does not constitute legal advice and does not establish a client-attorney relationship.